Michael Duchenne. I'm the Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute, and it's my pleasure to welcome you tonight to the second in our series of PERT Talks with our host, Robert Enright, a series that we're very pleased to be presenting in collaboration with our friends and colleagues at the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery. Tonight, we are delighted to welcome painter Eric Fischel to Perimeter Institute. Before I hand over the evening to Robert, I just want to tell you a little bit about how the evening is going to unfold. We will have Eric's talk first, followed by a short 15-minute intermission. We'll come back, eavesdrop in on a conversation on the stage between Eric and Robert. That will be followed by a question and answer period, and we will have ushers on both side aisles with microphones, so if you have a question, you put up your hand, and Mr. Enright will point at you, and please wait for the microphone to come your way. After the question and answer period, we will all retire to the fourth floor to the Black Hole Bistro. That part is totally optional. Our regular hangout spot after events at Perimeter Institute, we like to get together in the Black Hole, come up and meet Robert, meet Eric, have something to eat, something to drink. Hope you will join us up there. As I said, we're delighted to again welcome our host, Robert Enright. Robert is the editor-at-large for Border Crossing magazine and the university research professor in art criticism in the Department of Fine Art and Music at the University of Guelph. Prior to his appointment at Guelph, he was a freelance writer and broadcaster with CBC Radio and Television, specializing in cultural journalism. He's contributed to numerous network shows, including The Journal, As It Happens, Sunday Morning, Arts National, and Stereo Morning. He's currently the visual arts correspondent for The Arts Today and a regular contributor to the Sunday edition. Professor Enright is also a regular contributor to the arts pages of the Globe and Mail, where he has published over 80 features and reviews, and as well, he has been the theater critic for CBC Radio in Winnipeg since 1998. Robert Enright is recognized as one of the finest interviewers in the country, as many of you can attest to if you were at our presentation with Mr. Bertinsky. He's conducted hundreds of interviews with some of the world's most important artists, and he has contributed essays and interviews to over 20 catalogs and has also written for numerous art magazines. Professor Enright has given papers, moderated panels, and lectured on visual arts and literature in universities and art galleries in Canada, the United States, Germany, and Japan. He's currently preparing two books of interviews for publication, as well as collaborating with American artist Jim Dine on a spoken biography. Please welcome Robert Enright.
Good evening. It's good to see a full house, and it'll be worth being here, as you'll soon find out. I want to thank both the collaborators in this idea, this series of artist talks, the Kitchener-Waterloo Art Gallery and Institute itself. I think it's a wonderful idea. And as I said the last time, it seems to me that the idea of there being a practice involved in both inquiring into quantum physics and how we make art in whatever discipline we're in, they have much more in common than they have in a sense of being disparate. So I think this is a series that makes some sense about the way in which things are made and how we think about the making of them. To introduce Eric Fischel, I'm not going to take very long because I suspect in looking at the audience, I recognize lots of faces, and most of you probably know his work. Eric is one of America's finest painters now, and perhaps, in my estimation at least, one of the finest narrative painters, narratives of his own making, which I guess he'll address tonight, I've ever encountered. He has a Canadian connection, and I'm briefly going to address that tonight simply because he's in Canada, and he hasn't been in Canada much over the last 15 or 20 years. He did, of course, teach after doing a degree at CalArts. He was invited to teach at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, where he was asked to come up and teach painting, and as those of you who know the history of art in Canada, they invited him so that they could destroy him, since he was a painter and painting had died. And so they thought they should have somebody who may be able to argue the position of painting when he came up. Of course, the trouble was all of Eric's classes filled up very quickly. Everybody who studied with him wanted to paint. He stayed there for 4 years, and then in 1978 went with his then partner, the painter April Gornick, who is now his wife, to live in New York, and began a career that the adjective meteoric is always applied to what Eric, to what happened to Eric. His early shows at Inverthorpe Gallery were sensational in both senses of that term. They created a sensation, and the painting was pretty remarkable early on. And his career from that point on has been in a kind of intelligent painterly ascendancy. He hasn't been in Canada much. He was given an honorary doctorate at NASCAD a few years ago and came up for that. But the only two times I've heard Eric speak in Canada, or the only time I've heard him speak in Canada, actually, I believe, was at the Mendel Gallery in Saskatoon when his show opened in 1985, a show that originated with the Mendel Gallery and then toured everywhere else in the country. And in the interim time from the show starting to when it finally ended up in New York, Eric's career had gone in such a remarkable way that at that time I think his dealer wanted to sort of buy the show out, didn't really want it to appear in some of the places it was going because Eric was too big at that time, although Eric's dedication and loyalty to Canada, of course, persisted. And it was supposed to close, I believe, at the Gray Gallery, wasn't it, Eric? And then ended up, in fact, at the Whitney, which I guess is a measure of some kind of success, although I'm not so sure the Gray Gallery would see it that way. And he came to Winnipeg about a year later and gave a talk. And I think that's the last time he spoke in Canada. I mean, he's been to Canada before, and I think he talks when he's here, but not in this kind of context. So I'm delighted to introduce a painter of remarkable intelligence and vision and interest in the living world. I think we should be really pleased to have Eric Fisher here tonight to talk to us. So Eric, let's hear it.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Robert, for that introduction and for inviting me. And thank you, Michael, for having me here and participating in this series that you're doing. I have a few apologies to start with. I always like to start with apologies. One is that for dinner I ate a Caesar salad that had so much garlic that I'm afraid the first few rows are going to feel it. The other apology is my talk itself, which I wanted to, when I was asked to do it and to do it in such a prestigious place and to do it where there was, even the remote possibility that some kind of, physicist or something might hear it. I thought, I got to do something pretty big. I got to do it. So I immediately began looking for my grand unified field theory of art. And I thought I got it. You can imagine the pressure that it put on me to do it, but I think I got onto something, but as I got farther and farther into it, I realized how stupid I was and that I couldn't kind of get my head around the whole thing. So instead, you're going to see a fragment of what I think ultimately will become the grand unifying field theory of art, although this is just the small part of it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to, because in looking for my grand field unified blah, 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 something actually did occur to me that I'm fascinated by, still don't have a full grasp of, but I'm going to present some of that to you for your thoughts. So that'll be the second part of this 4-day talk. And then I'm going to show some of my work. I've organized that. It's a selected group of paintings over 30 years, but all sort of centering around the bed, which turns out I painted a lot of paintings that use that as some kind of an arena. So If I can actually get this thing going, we can start. So these are the three categories that we're going to discuss. My first, which is the unified field theory, goes something like this. Within the Western tradition of art making, there are three kinds of art that an artist can make. And they are either, they have to do with ideas about unity, ideas about chaos, ideas about transcendence, about harmony. They have to do with ideas of torment, expressions of physical, pain, discomfort, confusion. They have to do with linear kind of constructs. They have to do with ideas of non-hierarchical structures, which would become associated sort of with the heavenly vision of something, or with chaotic composition, serpentine forms, etc., which become part of a hellish structure. They have to do with color combinations that seem to be consistent throughout. Heavenly visions are painted in pastels, harmonizing color spectrums, etc. Hellish visions are painted in or portrayed in these dark dark umber, earthy tones, and fiery reds, oranges, etc., etc. They have to do with the relationship of the person to the self, to the body, to the either a sort of giving up of the self, the ambition, the vision, the hopes, the imaginative hope of a kind of transcendence of the body, or an entrapment in the body, and then sort of expression in those terms. And then there's what I call the garden art, which is the microcosmic, which is also the earthly, which is also the truly human, the heaven and the hell visions, how they get expressed in absolutes. And the absolutes of purity and unification, blah, blah, or the absolute of eternal torment, and the soul absolutely unable to separate itself from sensation, say. And then you have the garden, which is sort of the microcosmic view of those things. It's with the earthly thing, and it's temporal. It gives you the fleeting feeling, the sense of a kind of a delight of moment or something, not the absolute of a timeless space, but something along those lines. And then, of course, within the garden, you have a kind of split too. If you use it within the sort of the biblical sense of it, then you have a pre-lapsarian and a post-lapsarian. And before the fall, you have a kind of heavenly sense of man and nature living together, blah blah blah. And then you have in the post-lapsarian, the awareness of self, isolation, knowledge, sexual knowledge, blah blah blah, which takes you outside of that, separates you. And what I'm doing and just sort of presenting this to you is an idea. And there's like many, many examples that could be given that would sort of fit nicely into all these different categories that aren't stylistically, they're not a stylistic issue, they're a content issue. And they can, you know, I could show you stuff from, you know, 13th century when artists were using the narrative, the biblical narratives, the Christian narratives, to express these ideas about heaven, hell, and the garden. Or I can bring us up to, you know, my wife's work and in contemporary times, or an Agnes Martin painting or whatever, and try to make this the same case, which I think is credible to some extent. So what, right? So there you have that. So I'm struck by it because I think that it's like I'm wondering about whether the imaginative mind within the visual language is the most primitive. That you could have this like archetype. I actually think that you can find similar structures outside of Western culture. I think that you could find the use of form conveying sort of similar situations that would take place even within like a Buddhist a mandala or a you know Muslim thing or a primitive you know culture whatever but you know I haven't gotten that far but they have to do with the way form attaches itself to sensation and then the way the imagination would take it you know into an enlivened kind of space, the things that we fear, the things that we hope for, the things that we desire. All seem to have similar connections. And I think that those similarities are things that actually, you know, they're not about mood. It's not simply creating a mood of something. It's actually creating this kind of deep experience of it, which we're connected to. So, you know, I find similarities. I'm looking at this Grunewald and, you know, the sort of the animation of nature as a demonic thing. You know, the kind of creepy, crawly stuff as being a sort of hellish vision of something. And another thing, when I was looking at this, which is just an aside because I don't know where to go with it, but one of the ways of describing a hellish vision is the unclosable eye. That which I think for a painter may be a particularly poignant a metaphor for if the things that one sees are pained. Or not. Anyway, so that's the beginnings of the grand field theory. In doing that, sort of thinking about that, and thinking about the way that the imagination is connected to the experiences of the body, the way the body is connected to the forms that seem to express those fantasy fears, dreams, hopes, ideals, ambitions, desires, etc. I started thinking about this Van Gogh, and I was thinking, you know, 1870 or something like that, he cuts his ear off. That's not art. He makes a painting about it. That's art. 100 years later, Chris Burden has himself shot. Gina Pani does a performance piece in which she cuts herself with razor blades. Oops, sorry. I'm missing a Schwarzkogler, but Rudolf Schwarzkogler cuts his penis off. This is art. The documentation of it is not art. What happened in that 100 years that so turned the relationship of the body to the object? And to the creative object. And I started thinking about Rodin and about how Rodin was probably the last great sculptor of flesh and muscle, that he expressed in the Romantic period of the late 19th century, he embodied the sort of the Romantic, the grand tradition, the kind of, you know, self in a struggle with self, body in struggle with soul kind of thing that really animated his sculptures, and you felt it. You felt the body, you felt the muscles twitching, and the body twisting, and trying to some way physically be present, connect the thing, the inside, the outside. After Rodin, the modernist movement split within sculpture. It split, and part of it went in the direction of Matisse, who made these kind of wonderful physical sculptures with erotic distortions that sort of led into abstraction. And the other branch went to Giacometti, who continued the sort of existential angst of the 20th century that had begun with Rodin. The difference being that Giacometti portrayed anorexia, like the way of dealing with this torment, the way of dealing with the inside and the outside of the body was to take the body away. And to do it in this kind of withering, gnawing, eating at way that, you know, led to sculptures like this. Around the same time, in painting, Lucio Fontana stabbed the canvas and punctured it and sliced it, and he did a whole, you know, it's a life's work of scarring the canvas. In a way, you look back at his work from today, and it looks, you know, completely melodramatic and you know, kind of hysterical, kind of a quick cliche. At the time that he was doing it, it was a very radical thing to do. And why was it radical? The only way that it would have an effect would be if people actually believed that the body and the canvas were the same thing. That violence to the canvas was a direct assault on the sacred body of the painting, right? Shortly after that, the body did literally begin to leave the canvas. and not in favor of abstraction per se, but in terms of performative structures. So that, like this Eve Klein, where they would paint the body, and then the body would roll around on the surface, you know. The body wouldn't come from the canvas, but would be applied on top of the canvas to make something that sort of recorded the body. And then, of course, there was someone like Jackson Pollock, who literally stood inside the canvas, inside the arena of the canvas, and painted himself out of the canvas. So that sort of brings us up to something else. Now, this is a pretty shocking image, pretty disgusting image, I think. But I once saw this print called The Philosopher and His Muse. It was done in the 14th, 15th century, I think, German. And it was an old man who was being ridden around by a beautiful naked woman, and he had a bit and reins in his mouth, and he was, you know, and it was an image of this kind of pathos, of the humiliation and degradation of you know, this mystery, his greatest desire to understand, the search for knowledge and understanding. And here it was humiliating him and whatnot. But the goal, the thing, the muse, the mystery, what existed outside of him, even though on top of him in this case. And then I saw this Mapplethorpe, and I'm looking at the Mapplethorpe and thinking, God, you know, it's sort of like now, here he is dressed in cowboy, you know, chaps and stuff like that, and you know, cowboy vest and whatnot. So he's like the rider, but he's got this whip and in this humiliating position that forms this kind of serpent tail as it comes out, this devilish, hellish vision. And it's like in this one thing, the philosopher and the muse, the horse and rider, are now one. And so it's, in a way, serves as a good example of what I'm talking about in terms of where the body went when it left painting, and how the mysteries and the arena, the context, and all of that became a physical fact. I think personally I find it troubling and problematic, because it changes the relationship of not only the artist to himself, herself, but it changes the relationship of the viewer to the object of art. That there is a way that the viewer attaches to the object that is a participatory one that allows for experience and then for identification and empathy and, you know, et cetera, that becomes somewhat excluded when you're made to witness somebody doing some literally violent thing to themselves, which you have no sort of way of knowing why, how, and what to do about it actually. So it's paralyzing. Anyway, so that's my thought number two. And now I will begin showing some of my work, which has nothing to do with what I was talking about, except that it does. But it has to do with my work in that the body is everything to me. And I started a long time ago at a time when it really was, you know, not only was painting dead. See, the thing is, I guess, about this thing with when the body gets taken from art, it is a legitimate claim that painting is dead. You know, unless you're a heaven painter, unless you deal with that aspect of painting, which is about the absolutes of, you know, geometry and perfection of process and things like that, that, you know, are abstracted. Painting still lives in that, but the painting as a space for the other parts of the imagination, for the other parts of the earthly existence, for the other part, the hellish existence. It was closed off. It was eliminated when the body was taken out of the canvas. It's an analogy would be like once a Catholic stops believing that wafer is not the body of Christ, that's a pretty tasteless piece of dough, you know, and doesn't have the same kind of experiential weight to them that when they believed it did. Okay, so. For me, you know, when I started to paint the figure, and it wasn't a popular thing to do, it also was something that it was dawning on me how attached I felt to the reality of the physical and whatnot. So I preface my work by saying that. And what I'm going to show is work that goes from then till now, that all, for the most part, except for some of the recent work, have beds in them. And so it's over, you know, the 20 some odd years that I've been doing this, it's kind of exploring this arena of behavior that moves around and on this object, which is the bed, which is something that, you know, it's another way of exploring intimacy, another way of exploring desire, and the questions that surround those issues. I would say a little bit about, say, a painting like this, this one's called Master Bedroom, as you can see, and what I tried to do was set up a situation where you look at it with a certain, there's a certain kind of displacement there. I wanted to set some clues that this was not her room. This was not her bed. How do I do that? You know, I mean, obviously she's of an age, a young age, innocent, vulnerable age, when put in the context of this room, this arena, this even just the idea of a master kind of thing begins to shape your response to her situation. And there were a few things I did that, you know, to try to make it seem grown up. One was I put a cigarette in the ashtray. Of course, kids smoke now, so what the hell. But also, I wanted you to enter the painting not from where she was looking. So you're voyeuristically present as opposed to participatorily there. So she's looking askance. She's looking off to the side as though and there's a tension in it that sort of talks as if somebody either was leaving or coming into the room to her moment that she's in, and clearly she's hanging on to her dog. With a little more than just affection. And dumb dog doesn't seem to want to protect her, though. Bad dog. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking about that. And I'm, I, you know, for me, I'm, I've in trying to construct narratives, I'm trying to figure out ways within the language of painting to engage the audience and to involve them or not involve them, depending on my feelings about the situation. And so, you know, I look to things like the clues of the painting. So as I said in the last one, the fact that you're looking at somebody who's not looking at you but is looking off to the side sets up a triangulation. That's one device that I use in creating a kind of narrative moment. Another one, which is something that has interested me for a long time, is trying to deal with time in painting that is different than the frozen moment or maybe even the epic production of some work. And one of the ways I found to do it, as in this painting here, where you're looking at a diptych in which there are two rooms presented, which, you know, with the language, the vernacular language of motels, for example, this could be the same room on two different days. Or it could be two different rooms on the same day, just down the hall from each other. You know, that's the sort of the irony of, you know, these architectural spaces that duplicate everything exactly the same. So then you're kind of torn between, well, if it's the same room at different times, you're watching two different activities, obviously, one and you know of a delight and the other of isolation. And it's even possible in terms of an interpretive nature that the woman and the one on the left could be the woman and the one on the right after the lovemaking. So it just sets up a kind of ambiguity that you know brings, I think, the audience deeper into the narrative moment. Another way that I tried to develop the use of time was, which actually harkens back to some early work of mine that I did on glassine paper when I was living in Halifax. Glassine is a transparent paper, and I would build scenes by painting a chair on one piece of paper and then overlaying another sheet on it. I'd ask myself questions, you know, is somebody sitting in the chair? Are they standing next to the chair? Are they walking by the chair? Are they crawling underneath the chair? Is there more than one person here? Is the chair near a table above it? You know, whatever. And I would just kind of make these scenes. And they had, because they were all on separate elements, they had this feeling of a temporality, that this was the scene at this moment, and you take one away and the scene starts to change. This person leaves the room, another person enters. Years later, I tried to sort of reach back and kind of do that in painting as well, using separate canvases. I just have a whole bunch of canvases in my studio, and I just start painting an image, and then it would lead to the next, and etc. These things would build. In a painting like this, I tried to kind of set up a memory space. And it's not necessarily one that would be apparent from the frontal, from the middle ground where the two separate canvases kind of flatten out, the horizons line meet up, and it looks like a mother and her young daughter in some kind of moment. But because one canvas is actually cantilevered out from the other, the minute you move from one side to the other, the synthesis of those two breaks apart. And now it seems like, gee, maybe it's a different time thing. That it's like Is it her and before? Is it the mother remembering herself as a child? Is it the child sort of projecting herself into the future? Whatever the those kind of questions come up. Here's a painting in which I struggled terribly because I painted this woman on this bed, and then I kept thinking, why do I keep feeling like this is not her bed? Why do I keep thinking this is not her room? Am I projecting a kind of racism, a kind of racial stereotyping into the situation? Why can't this be her room? Blah, blah, blah. And I kept searching for ways of answering my own question as to how to either make it hers or make it clear that it's not hers. And I, it went through all kinds of ways of projecting ownership. And I think the painting kind of ends up with that actually being the question. So here's a painting that explores a rather small moment of time and directly involves you as the viewer, because it's pretty much the time it takes for you to enter and have her look at you, notice that you've come in. So it's a small time frame. I was talking to somebody the other day, and I was talking about this thing that I find curious, although it became clear to me at the end of the conversation with this person, because when I first started making the paintings that you've been seeing, when reviewers would review shows or whatever, that early on, they would talk about Manet and Degas and that tradition, and so they'd create a linkage with me and that kind of painting, that time period, etc. And then I started to make sculpture, and when they reviewed it, they would say Rodin, end of discussion, period. And it was like, you cannot do that now. Rodin ended something, you can't go back, blah, blah, blah. And so I was puzzled by it. Why one and not the other? And I was talking to somebody, and they said that it felt like somehow I was able to bring painting forward in a way that the sculpture feels a little bit, is very much a part of the romantic 19th century tradition. And I said, well, partly it was because in painting I was acknowledging the influence of photography and film. That, in fact, my paintings have been a way of trying to define what painting is, either against what photography is and against what film is, or also using stuff that they had brought to the table that kind of enriched my visual experience. Certain aspects of time, and the reason I stopped at this was precisely that, this sort of idea of a kind of sequence, a framing sequence, a very filmic idea for conveying an activity. In this case, again, a relatively short period of time of watching someone dress, but nonetheless sort of, using that kind of filmic sequencing. And here's another example of that. I can't figure out the equivalent in sculpture. Again, going back to the body, what happened with sculpture after Giacometti, the next sort of great or important sort of movement in sculpture after Giacometti that, again, wasn't about abstraction, was body casting. You think of George Segal and Dwayne Hansen and D'Andrea, et cetera. Now, the thing about body casting is that it traditionally comes from the death mask. So it's an acknowledgement of a death of some sort. And the reason it's a death is because it's literal. It's only the size that the hand, that particular hand is. It's only the size that body literally is. So it doesn't have the imaginative power of transformation in a grand way. It can change material, but it's limited. It's limited to literal gestures, for example. And if I've rejected that, because the kind of sculpture I make is I model. I use clay or wax, whatever I model. And so then it's like, well, I wonder what. So I've rejected casting. Now I wonder what else there is that exerts that kind of pressure on sculpture, figurative sculpture today, that one would have to grapple with the same way the painter has to deal with photography and film. Obviously that's a question. I have no idea. The next five paintings I'll show you are a sequence that I did that didn't start out as a sequence. It started out just doing this painting. And I finished this painting, and I was looking at it, and I thought, how could these people be so close to each other, and I can't see them simultaneously? How is it that as I look, I get totally absorbed in her, and I lose him, yet he hangs over her that way? Or then I notice him, and she disappears. How could that possibly be? So I started thinking about one might be the fantasy of the other. And in that case, that sort of connected me to travel, because there's always this erotic component to travel. So I thought, oh, great, so one of them is real, one's not, there's this fantasy element going on. Let me see where it goes. So, I did another painting trying to kind of see where they were in relationship to each other, and I'd set it up in the confines of a very small space, which is this room, and I just started to follow them around. And the second painting, I painted him in as well as her, and I just kept painting him out and kept moving him farther and farther out of the frame. But still, there's her like engagement with him, her looking in his direction or something like that. And he then never again appeared in real form after that, but appeared in sort of echoes, like the black figure in the tapestry in the background, or still again her looking, in this case, not at the mirror, but just past the mirror, off the thing, as though he was again outside the picture frame. And again, he shows up in the kind of mask in the background. And then not. Now, I finished this group of five paintings, and I realized that I had done something else that I wasn't conscious of as I was doing it, but seemed to fit, which is that in the first painting, she is a kind of an egg form. And then in the second, she crawls. In the third, she stands up. In the fourth, she's bent. And in the fifth, she returns to an egg. And so within the course of this fairly narrow period of time, which could be over an evening or a few hours in this room in her fantasy world with herself, the portrayal was a trajectory of a life. Now, this was a painting that was actually suggested to me. And it was suggested to me not in its appearance, but a dealer friend of mine who's a poet and an art historian and an intellectual and whatnot had this idea that Edward Hopper did these two paintings 10 years apart. They're like bookends. One is called Summertime, and it's an image of a woman in a sort of a smock sitting on the edge of a bed, sunlight streaming through the window, and behind her is a naked man sleeping. And then 10 years later, he does this painting of a man sitting clothed on the edge of the bed with a book open, kind of looking down, not reading, the book's just open, and behind him is a naked woman sleeping. And it's called A Journey into Philosophy, I think, or something like that. And so this guy Mario Diacono suggested that maybe I could do a painting that in some way talked about or entered into a dialogue with these Hoppers, which intrigued me, and I to kind of let it gestate for a few years, and then I ended up doing this painting, which in some way sort of talks to that, what I was understanding about those two paintings. Both of them seem to be about, desire and unfulfillment, disappointments, relationships that are, sort of misfiring, whatnot, things that sort of throw you back on yourself, your interior dialogue, monologue. Anyway, so I did this painting, and the upshot of it was that I loved painting that chair. It was just, it in a way, when I looked at this painting, I thought, God, it's, and somehow the either the consciousness is in the chair, or the way we're going to understand what's going on is in the chair. Somehow that chair has got something more than whatever else is going on. So it moved me into a body of work which is called The Bed, The Chair, and then something, and it was a series of work in which this chair, sometimes there were two of them, and the bed were always there. So it was the same room, and then different characters that would go out. Each painting was like a different thing, and so I kind of changed my scope by controlling just the environment and then watching different people behave in that environment. Don't ask me what's going on. It's one of those things, you just kind of think, well, that works. This is a situation that the what I'm going to say is that all things I would hope people would get at some time, not necessarily right away, whether they do or not, or whether it actually is important, I don't know. But, this is a painting in which the guy is looking at you. And no matter where you are, he's looking at you, okay? And there's an image, a shadow on the back wall. And the shadow, this dancer, feels like it's a female dancer. It's nude. So where's that shadow coming from? The implication is the shadow's coming from you, but he's watching you dancing, right? If you're a girl, that's one thing. If you're a guy, it's something else. Because for the guy, it's a big transformation. But not an uninteresting thing to sort of think about. I'm always interested in, you know, it's another sort of painting device. You have, you know, foreground, middle ground, background, space, whatever. When you construct a painting, you have things that you can manipulate to sort of engage the relationship between the viewer and the thing being viewed, and you know, some of it is like, you know, how easy do I want access to this painting? What do I want to make the viewer do in order to get to the thing that they think they're supposed to be looking at, or the thing that makes them most curious? How do I, you know, do I throw objects in their way to make them crawl over something? Here's certainly a good example of, you know, creating a kind of mountain of stuff that the viewer has to imaginatively leap over to see the thing that ignites their curiosity. And you know, in other cases, you know, like the one where the guy is just looking at you, becomes another way of setting up a relationship to the viewer. See, I think that certainly the artists in here, I think, would probably agree. But, you know, the viewer is everything in the experience of a work of art. And, you make a painting, you make a work of art trying to imagine the viewer, trying to imagine how the viewer is going to be pulled in, how you're going to set up this experience for them. Oh, I just thought of something that I wanted to say earlier. I was listening to an NPR show about science and religion. And I forget the scientist's name. He was a microbiologist. He was talking about awe. He was talking about in his work, he sees things that these kind of natural forms, these things that inspire awe in him. And he said that the experience of awe that leads to curiosity is science. The experience of awe that leads to reverence is religion. And I was telling this to my wife, April Gornick, and she said, yeah, and the experience of awe that creates the desire to recreate the experience of awe is art. Ooh, gave me the chills too. It's fucking amazing! Yeah. Now, this last body of work that I'm going to show, and we're almost done, is my most recent stuff for the last couple, 3 years. Actually, the project's been sort of 4 years, but it started with an opportunity from a museum in Germany, in Krefeld, Germany. They own this these two Mies van der Rohe houses, Mies van der Rohe's first modernist residences. And they use them as galleries for artists to do special sort of site-specific exhibitions in. And they invited me to do something, asking me what I would do if I were given the opportunity. And so I said, well, you know, there used to be a house. People used to live there. I do paintings about people living in houses. I'll hire a couple of actors. I'll furnish the house. We'll do like a photo shoot with them acting out different things in different rooms of the house, and I'll go away. I'll make the paintings, and we'll put the paintings back in the rooms that this sort of fictional family lived in for, you know, whatever. And so that's what I did. I hired these two German actors, and I furnished the house. We took a bunch of photographs, and then for the last 3 years, I've been sort of feeding off of that. The show in Krefeld was a year and a half ago, in which the paintings, there was a living room series of paintings, of which this is one. There was a dining room series. There were a couple of dining room. There was a couple of sunroom and a bedroom and a bathroom painting. And then after that show, I still had so much material, and I was still so engaged in this couple and my sort of fictional world of theirs that I just continued to do pictures of them. So that's what this work is. And I didn't script it. It was interesting working with actors. I'd never worked with actors before. I've use models, but I really don't respond to models other than as a practice for drawing or whatever. Because I don't respond to posing. What I respond to is posture, body language. That's what triggers my imagination. That's what gets my narrative going. I see somebody sitting a certain way, holding their shoulders a certain way, you know, holding their arms a certain way, and I immediately start imagining where we've come to that creates that thing. And you know, if you put it in relationship to somebody else, is it a turning towards, a turning away from? Is it an internal thought meeting an external stimulus, blah, 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 right? It's all that kind of stuff. And so I try not to control the situation. I just try to set up something that I can look, that I can watch. And as I said, I never worked with actors. I have a lot of friends who are playwrights and movie directors and theater directors and stuff like that. So, of course, I called them and I said, you know, how do you deal with actors? You know, are they human? You know, do you talk to them or do you just abuse them? You know, what do you, you know? And the best advice I got was from a friend who said, oh, they love problem solving. Just give them problems and they'll go to town. And I said, well, what do you mean? What's a problem? They went, oh, really simple stuff. She wants to borrow $100 from him, but she won't tell him why. Just, you know, something like that. They love it. You know, they'll go to town. So that's what I did. And so we would do this shoot, and I, you know, as I said, I didn't script anything, but I would set up a situation. I like that, you know, she wants this or whatever. In this case, it was something about, you know, he comes home with a gift of this robe. So just go from there. And the actors were fantastic. They'd make up their own dialogue. They'd yak away. They'd do this. And I was surprised by two things. One is I was surprised by how fast I realized that nothing was going on and nothing would go on, that it just was not happening. It blew my mind that I could, without having an overall vision, without having a script, without having any, you know, whatever, I could see that this wasn't going to happen. And then I'd throw out something else and we'd change it and it would go. The other thing that blew my mind was that sometimes it was so riveting that I'd forget to take pictures. I'd just be like, you know. So. Now, the other thing is that several years ago, I started using Photoshop as a tool. I've always used photography as a source material for my work, except for my most early work, the glassine drawings and stuff like that. But pretty much since the 80s on, I'd use photography. The one thing that photography gave me was that it slices time so thin that you get those moments of awkwardness in the body. You get the, you know, it's like nobody looks composed in a photograph, you know, like, you know, from shot to shot. They only look composed 1 second, or 32nd of a second, actually, and then they twitch and change and whatever, and it goes into this other realm, which becomes more expressive. So it's through the photograph that I've learned a lot about, you know, the narrative and the body language and stuff like that. But I was schooled as a by a bunch of faculty that were abstract expressionist second generation painters, and a lot of their stuff was about the kind of you know, ideas of abstract expressionism, one of them being that, you know, this kind of authenticity where intention and execution, discovery and execution had to happen simultaneously on the canvas. So the idea of knowing ahead of time what you were going to paint, no. It's funny how you carry prejudices around for so long. But that was one of the things with the... So with the photograph, when I would use photographs, I'd actually, you know, I'd sit there and hold a little photograph with a figure in it, and I'd take that figure and I'd draw it, and then I'd go get another one, and I'd sit and think, well, I'll put it over here, you know. So I was discovering the narrative as I was creating it. Now, what Photoshop did was separate discovery from execution, because with Photoshop, you do all that cutting and pasting in the program. You run through a zillion ideas. You know, you're turning this figure this way. You're enlarging this. You're changing that. The light. The blah 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 blah. Boom! You got the thing that really is the image you want and whatnot. And then I would go paint. So I was worried at first that it would kill the painting, that the painting would just be an illustration of the photo that I'd made. What I found, ironically, was that it freed me to paint, so that somehow the I could explore actually a lot of the more subtle, and I could appreciate in a more direct way the pleasures of painting. By doing that, by not worrying what it was that I was painting, because I already went through that. So that was the process by which I got to these things. And what you see is a constructed painting. There isn't a painting I made in which they both were doing what they were doing in the painting at the same time in the photograph. She comes from one place, he comes from another, et cetera. And at some point during the project, I decided that I would give them some artwork. It being Germany, I gave them their favorite artists. So we have a Bruce Nauman on the neon, the Andy Warhol, and then the Gerhard Richter on the other side, and a Max Beckmann, of course. April was convinced he was a porno actor. And it was kind of interesting. I mean, I actually hired them from the internet. You know, a kind of casting call went out, and they sent me their websites. And I don't read German. So I don't know. I wasn't looking at anything but their face. They say, oh, that's the kind of face I'd like to work with, you know. So when we got together for the first meeting, he walks in. He's exactly what I was hoping for, this big, strapping German guy, corn-fed, you know. Like, oh. And she comes in, and she's like this tall. And I'm like kind of going, oh, this is going to be really interesting, you know, et cetera. Anyway, he seemed to think that, I don't know whether he was just looking at my paintings beforehand or whatnot, but he just seemed to feel that there should be sex in every room. And that whatever their thing was, somehow was going to go there, you know? And he also didn't seem to be particularly uptight about being aroused in front of other people. And I wasn't looking for this kind of stuff. I really wasn't. But I kept thinking, well, maybe that's just German. You know? I don't know. Anyway, in sort of real time, you could see that there was a lot of tension between the two. She wasn't interested in him at all. So there was that going on, and it kind of culminated in the bedroom scene that we did on the final day of shooting. You know, now he was sure this is where it's going to happen, because now we are in the bedroom, right? And anyway, I tried to set up something before, like this thing. You know, they were out all night. They're in their evening clothes. They're kind of bombed. You know, come home. Da da da. It wasn't really happening, and he got up, he left, went to the bathroom, and I said, look, I'd chosen this bed, which I think you saw before here, which was this sort of weird modernist Italian idea of a bed with a mosquito net over it, this kind of igloo of a mosquito net. So I told her, I said, look, take off your clothes, get in the bed, you're a wild animal. Whatever you do, don't let him in the bed. So she kind of went into this incredible body thing and just became this animal. It was fantastic, and she recoiled all the way to the back, and among the pillows, and the nettings down, you know. And he comes back in the room, and he sees her naked in the bed. Ooh. So he gets undressed, you know. And he walks over to the bed, and he starts to lift up the mosquito net, and she comes flying across the bed and smashes him right in the face. Right? And he goes like, whoa! Whoa! And I'm going, oh! It was funny. Anyway, so these last couple of images are the most recent of that work. Okay, there you have that. So, I think what we're taking a break now and come back and chat. Thank you.